Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, the perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, were you involved last week in the Palestine-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's illegal military occupation and colonization of their homeland? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, why not? Palestine was never in greater need of your help. Here are a few examples of ways you can help. One, you could join the Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights by going to its website at bcpr.net or by calling 617-491-2313. Two, you could join the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee of Massachusetts by going to its website at adcma.org. Three, you could join the Middle East Crisis Coalition by writing to crisismiddleeast@yahoo.com. Four, you could join the Israel-Palestine Task Force of United for Justice with Peace by writing to ujpiptaskforce@yahoo.com. Five, if you are Jewish and prefer to join a Jewish group, there is the Boston chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, which you can contact either by calling 617-984-0532 or by visiting its website at vopj.org, where you can also volunteer to participate in the JVP Health and Human Rights Project to help provide medical aid to Palestinians and help raise global awareness of the effects of Israel's occupation on the health and welfare of the populations living under it. Six, you could go to Palestine and help with the olive harvest or help Palestinians live their daily lives under occupation by contacting the group Boston to Palestine at its website, bostontopalestine.org. Seven, you could work with the International Women's Peace Service in Palestine by applying to iwps-pal.org. Eight, you could go to Palestine under the Birthright Unplugged program, or nine, under the Needle in the Groove program, by applying respectively at birthrightunplugged.org and needleinthegroove.org. It is Sunday, May 11th, 2008. As Israeli and diaspora Jews celebrate the 60th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel, an increasing number of people around the world have started to ask questions about the circumstances of its creation and the myths they have been fed during all those years. More and more people are beginning to acknowledge the fact that Israel was not created of immaculate conception, and that the Zionist leaders of Israel had intentionally destroyed the fabric of Palestinian civil society to found their state by mass terror campaigns, massacres of thousands, depopulation of 500 Palestinian villages, and expulsion of about 690,000 out of the 850,000 Palestinians, or more than 80% of the Palestinian population then living in the area now called Israel. On April 30th, the British newspaper The Guardian published a letter written by Nobel Prize-winning novelist Harold Pinter and signed by 105 British Jews, writers, actors, well-known academics, and public figures, explaining why they were not celebrating Israel's anniversary. It says, in part, and I quote, "We cannot celebrate the birthday of a state founded on terrorism, massacres, and the dispossession of another people from their land. We cannot celebrate the birthday of a state that even now engages in ethnic cleansing, that violates international law, that is inflicting a monstrous collective punishment on the civilian population of Gaza, and that continues to deny to Palestinians their human rights and national aspirations. We will celebrate when Arab and Jew live as equals in a peaceful Middle East." Unquote. Others who have cancelled their commitments to attend celebrations in Israel include Russell Banks, President of the International Parliament of Writers, Barbara Streisand, Bono, lead singer of the U2 band, and the remaining Beatles. The colossal elephant in the room that everyone in this country is determined to ignore is Zionism and its legacy of savage brutality. Originally billed as a plea for a homeland where Jews would be safe from the persecutions in Europe, Zionism took on the mantle of moral imperative, particularly after the horrors of the Holocaust became known at the end of World War II. The Zionists who became Israel's leaders were acutely aware of the big role the moral argument played at partition. And from that point on, projecting a favorable image of moral rectitude became the central concern of every government of Israel to this day. Having succeeded in persuading the world to accept the carefully crafted, idealized image of Zionism, it became imperative to hide at all costs the dark side of Zionism, which calls for the conquest of land belonging to Israel's neighbors and the deconstruction and annihilation of all neighboring nations along the way, which Israel has been pursuing for several years with the United States. That dark side of Zionism is what fuels Israel's savageries in Gaza and the West Bank. It is a criminal enterprise, and it must be stopped. Israel's leaders and their agents in the official Jewish organizations in the diaspora have for years cultivated in their communities a false identification of Zionism with Judaism, going so far as making any criticism of Zionism equivalent to anti-Semitism, and forcing Jewish communities everywhere to become partners in Israel's crimes. In addition, the public relations campaigns in Europe and the United States over many decades, demonizing Palestinians and Arabs, and pounding in the fraudulent moral image of Zionism, have so deeply grafted the images of the criminal Arab and the righteous Israeli Jew, that despite widespread reports of Israel's crimes by independent human rights agencies, Europe and the United States will still not believe them or discount them as justified retaliation for crimes committed by Palestinian criminals, as if desperately trying to salvage the moral image they have of themselves. The formal founding of the State of Israel was hastened by global Christian guilt in what it regarded as final expiation of its criminal persecution of Jews throughout the ages. The question that begs to be asked but is never politically correct to ask is this: does condemning a guiltless people to death, expulsion, and perpetual destitution constitute proper atonement for the crimes committed against Jews by Christian Europe? To put it another way, there is no semblance of equivalence between Zionism and Judaism. Zionism is the antithesis of Judaism. It is a criminal enterprise, and it must be fought and stopped dead on its tracks. The time to celebrate is when Palestinians and Israelis are allowed by their leaderships to live together as equals, with equal dignity and respect for their personhood. Only then will we see a real peace in the Middle East. Our featured guest today is Rachel Baker. Rachel is a young artist, resident of Waltham, and incoming student at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. She has recently returned from a two-week delegation to Israel and Palestine. The trip was co-sponsored by Interfaith Peace Builders and the National Peace Foundation. The purpose of this delegation, which was the 26th delegation to make the trip to Israel and Palestine since 2001, was to raise awareness among North American citizens about the region and deepen their understanding of its conflicts. Interfaith Peace Builders and National Peace Foundation delegates had a unique experience of learning about the Middle East through the eyes of those who live there. Good morning, Rachel, and welcome to This Week in Palestine.
Thank you.
You have a very interesting background, Rachel. You've already spent some years helping people around the world. You served 3 years as a Peace Corps volunteer in Guinea, West Africa, where you taught English to high school students. You coordinated an HIV/AIDS program, and you traveled Europe and Asia. Why Palestine? What motivated you to go to Palestine and Israel?
I was interested in Palestine and Israel because I, previous to going, I knew nothing about the situation there. I knew that Israel existed, and I knew that there was some problems, and I knew that there was some conflict, but I really was overwhelmed by the amount of history and information available, and so I just pretty much didn't pay attention to it. And when I heard about this trip with Interfaith Peace Builders, I decided that I want to go and see what there is to see and learn. And I'm amazed at what I've learned.
You spent 2 weeks on that trip. Where did you go in the West Bank and Gaza?
We stayed in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, and we visited Ramallah and Hebron, and we also drove up the coast of the Dead Sea and up along the Jordan River and visited Nazareth and also Bethlehem.
Did you visit Israel as well?
Yes, we did. We visited Tel Aviv and Jaffa.
Mm-hmm.
We also visited a small town called Sderot, which is right next to the Gaza Strip.
Could you share with our listeners what you did and saw while you were there?
Mm-hmm. When we visited Sderot, that's a small village right outside of Gaza, and it has been attacked by rockets over the years. And we met with a couple of different small groups who are working to try to create some peace in their village and their town. And in addition to speaking with the people in Sderot, we also visited and met with other organizations who are working to try to make the situation for Palestinians better. We spoke with Adala, which is the Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, and we spoke with another group called Physicians for Human Rights, who mostly work on getting health care for immigrants into Israel. We spoke with another group called Beth Salam, which is the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in Occupied Territories.
What did you learn while you were there, Rachel, that opened your mind?
What I've discovered is that the life for Palestinians is very difficult. They are harassed nearly daily, depending on what they're doing. We spoke with students from Berzit University, which is a Palestinian university outside of Ramallah, and we spoke with a student who lived in East Jerusalem, and every day when she would go to school, she would have to go through a checkpoint and show her ID and wait and patiently until she could get through. Sometimes she would have to leave very early in the morning in order to get to classes on time. Sometimes the checkpoints weren't open exactly when they were supposed to be open. Sometimes there would be some reason why people weren't being let through. And so oftentimes she would be late to class, and if she was late to class, she then couldn't attend classes. And we heard of stories like this continuously for different people who were trying to get to work or trying to get to wherever they were trying to get to.
Could you tell me if you had an impression of Palestinians before you went to Palestine? What was your impression of them from what you have heard or read in the press or in the media?
I've always heard that, from our media in America, I always heard that Palestinians were terrorists and people who were out to do damage to Israelis. And I was suspicious of that. I tend to think that our media isn't giving us the full story or is just giving us a biased story. And so I went to the West Bank and Palestine with an open mind, and I generally approach people as thinking that they're honest and good and wonderful, caring people.
And did you find them to be honest and caring and welcoming and hospitable?
Yes, very much so. We went to, one evening we stayed in the Dehasha refugee camp with Palestinians, and the family that welcomed us were wonderful and welcoming and very knowledgeable about the situation. And we had a tour all through the refugee camp, and everyone who we spoke with was very happy to see us and welcoming. We also had a homestay in Hebron, and all of us stayed in different houses of different Palestinian families, and I stayed with one woman and her family, and they were wonderful, and they fed us incredible food and welcomed us into their homes as family.
Even though they are very poor and hardly able to feed themselves.
Yes, that is correct.
Did you see, while you were in Hebron, did you see the settlers and how they oftentimes attack Palestinians and harass them?
Yes, we did. We walked through the old city in Hebron, and as you walk through the old streets, which are Palestinian areas where there are stores and places to sell things to tourists, up above the streets there is sort of chicken wire spread across the road, and that is to protect the Palestinians and anyone who's shopping from the rocks and various items that are thrown down by the settlers above. The very day that we were there, the people down below told us that some of the settlers above had dumped dirty water down on people. And so this is still continuing, even when we were there.
Did you notice that all the stores were closed in what used to be the central marketplace in Hebron?
Mm-hmm. We walked along one street that is completely deserted. I have a photograph of it, and every single shop is closed, and there is not a person on the street. And up above the stores is where the settlers live. And in that area, we actually did speak with one rabbi, and he gave us a tour of the settlement and spoke with us at great length about that this was his homeland, and he had a very interesting point of view.
Could you share with us his point of view?
Yes, he was... he told us that that the land was given to Israelis as from God, and that he truly believed that the whole land was for them. And he did not really speak with us too much about Palestinians. When we asked him about the Palestinians who no longer could work in the stores below, he sort of moved on to another subject. And I understand his desire for a homeland and his desire for safety and security, but I wonder about the people who are being removed in order to create that.
Yes, well, that's the whole point, isn't there? But there is another part. I don't know if you had the opportunity of speaking with rabbis about that divine covenant, promised the land of Israel to Jews. There was a condition attached to that, and the condition was that they follow the teachings of the Torah. The teachings include compassion, justice, also the fact that the land was also that God entered into a covenant with Ishmael, who the ancestor of the Arabs,
mm-hmm.
and promised him the land. So it was twice promised to different people on condition. And certainly there is much debate about whether the covenant still holds today. But that unconditional acceptance of a covenant as being theirs and theirs only is, as I understand it, wrong when it is interpreted by rabbis themselves. The Bible is not unconditional in that sense. Certainly the fact that that Jews need a homeland where they will be safe from persecution, that is given. And as I pointed out in my leading material, it takes on a moral imperative. What is disturbing is what you have pointed out yourself, saying that whether the destruction of another people to get that homeland is part of the deal. What else have you learned while you were there? Have you been out with farmers to their lands and seen them abused at checkpoints? Or is there an event or an observation that moved you the most when you were in the West Bank in Gaza?
Yes, there was one place that we visited. There's one farm that's owned by a Christian Palestinian, and it's now called Tent of Nations, and he invites international people from other countries to come and help harvest the olives. And we visited his farm, and he has papers showing that he owns it from 1916, and he has documents from all of the different from the Ottoman Empire to the British Mandate, through when Jordan was in control of the land. And he has all of the paperwork that shows that he does own the land. And all around his farm, on all of the hills around him, there are Israeli settlements moving in. And we took a walk through his farm and walked all over it. And everywhere we turned, there was a settlement on a village, or on the hill, the next door hill. and he was explaining his experiences in the court systems where he was trying to prove that he owned the land. And each time he would go in with some paperwork, the courts would look at it and say, okay, well, this is great, but now we need some eyewitnesses. And so he would have to go back and try to find people who could be considered eyewitnesses. And then he would go back with them, and they would say again, okay, well, this is good, but now we need this next document. And so it was it's an ongoing process where he's been working to prove that he owns the land. And in the meantime, he set up summer camps so that children can come and sort of see the situation. And it's just incredible what he's been doing.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other events you would like to speak about to us during your trip? Did you actually go out and harvest olives, or did you talk to some of the settlers themselves in the West Bank, other than Hebron?
We were unable to speak with any of the other settlers. We spoke with Israeli groups that were working to try to find some kind of peaceful solution to what's going on over there. We spoke with one Israeli lawyer who works with Adala, and she explained what her group was doing and trying to work within the Israeli court system to try to make life better for Palestinians. One of the problems that we saw repeatedly is that there are small Palestinian villages in the West Bank which are not considered to be actual villages. They don't have permits for their houses, and they can't build any more houses because they can't get permits. Oftentimes they don't have schools or hospitals or any kind of health care. And so this group, Adala, was working to try to get a health van that would drive over to the villages where people could see a doctor. And in that process, they were looking to try to make it so that the villages could then become legal villages.
How about the wall? What were your impressions of that wall?
The wall in Jerusalem is everywhere. It is, I understand that it's supposed to separate Israelis from Palestinians, but oftentimes the root of the wall goes right through neighborhoods that are Palestinian. And so what happens is there will be Palestinian families on each side of the wall. And in some cases now those families cannot visit each other. The wall is very, very tall. I don't know how many feet, but quite tall in some places. And it just is, you can look down the road and see it over, like down the road, and then you can turn around and continue and you see it again. And it just is all encompassing.
Did you go through checkpoints yourselves as along with everybody else, not with your American passport?
We went through. We went through one gate or one checkpoint, which is just outside of Jerusalem on our way into the West Bank. And we had to stand in a very long line, and we waited until we got to the door. And then we went through a little spinning thing and put our bags through an X-ray machine. And then we had to walk through a metal detector. And then we had to show our passports. And then we had to pick up all of our stuff and go out. And it was quite a process. And while we were there, there was one small Palestinian boy who was trying to go through, and he didn't have any baggage with him, no backpack or anything. He just didn't have the right paperwork, so he was made to turn around. And we saw this a couple of times with different people at that same checkpoint.
How about people who need to who need medical care and who try to go through the checkpoint?
We didn't actually witness anyone who needed medical care, but we did hear about people who were in Gaza who tried to get out, and there's a very long, complicated process where the doctors in Gaza have to recommend that they seek other care, and it has to go through this process of getting a permit by a certain date, and then they need to sort of send the permit back, and it's a very long process, and oftentimes people are turned back and can't leave.
There are more than 100 people who died waiting for, waiting to be let in, even though most of them had the paperwork done.
Mm-hmm.
They had
yes.
the permits, and they had the references from Physicians for Human Rights Israel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yet they were not allowed through, and many, many have died.
Yes.
When you returned, Rachel, did you give any talks here?
Yes, I've given one conversation at my church, and I've also spoken with the people who I work with, and many different friends and anyone who will listen. I also had an interview with a local paper here.
Mm-hmm. How was your talk received? How were you able to communicate what you saw on your trip with others? How did they react to you?
I find that it's very difficult to speak about it. I find as soon as I mention anything that sounds somewhat pro-Palestinian or is pro-Palestinian or concerns about the lives of Palestinians, there's an immediate jump to conclude that I am anti-Semitic, and I have to sort of stop and sort of re-explain that that's not what I'm saying and that that is definitely not true, and I have to sort of point out that I'm only talking about what I saw with my eyes on the ground in Palestine. And it, I've had a couple of people who've had very strong reactions to what I was talking about and demanded that I talk about the Israeli side. And it's difficult because many of the people we spoke with are Israelis, and I am talking about the Israeli side. But it's a very difficult and complex situation to talk about. There isn't just one side and the other side. There are many, many, many different viewpoints. And I'm trying, each time I speak about it, I try to figure out ways that I can talk about the living conditions for Palestinians while also recognizing that the Israeli people and the population is also very scared and concerned. And it's hard to talk about both of these things without people being upset. I also find that it sometimes seems like it's a generation. I feel like younger generations, maybe people who did not live during the Holocaust, during that time period, that younger people are maybe able to look at it with sort of a different kind of, from a different viewpoint, as opposed to the more older people that I've spoken with tend to be coming from what they've heard and what they've heard throughout their lives.
Yes, well, of course, the Holocaust was an abomination.
Mm.
But an equal abomination was also the Nakba. The fact that more than 80% of Palestinians were expelled from their homes, were massacred, were robbed, and the robbing of lands and demolition of homes continues to this day.
Mm-hmm.
That is an equal abomination, and to deny it is just like denying the Holocaust.
Mm.
What is an abomination to Jews, the Nakba is an abomination to Palestinians, and that ought to be recognized. But as you say, you'll find it, I guess you'll have to find a way to speak about things that is not taken immediately to be anti-Semitic.
Yes.
Now that you have returned, and I guess you're preparing to go to Berkeley,
yes.
Is there anything that you would like to do now? That would continue your work on the Palestinian issue?
I would like to continue to speak about it, and I would very much like to encourage people to try to go and see for themselves what's going on. I realize it's not possible for many, many, many people, but I think to go and meet Palestinians and see what's happening in the West Bank is just incredibly eye-opening, and there's no way that I can remain silent after seeing what I've seen. And I believe that people in America really need to go and see, or at least maybe listen, and maybe if our media could give a more balanced point of view of what's happening over there.
Yeah, as you said, I think the key issue is for people to go there and see things for themselves, mm-hmm. rather than be judgmental,
mm-hmm.
and either refuse or accept what's going on. That is absolutely key. I think you're quite right there. In a few minutes remaining to us, Rachel,
okay. mm-hmm.
is there anything more you would like to communicate to young Americans, students, and so on? Is there anything you would like to say?
I would recommend learning about the situation and the occupation and being open-minded to hearing different viewpoints. I definitely would recommend listening to many different people and asking questions and not believing everything that they hear from the media.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Rachel. Thank you very much for being our guest today. I guess you've run out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. You've been listening to Rachel Baker, a student with the seminary in Berkeley, who recently visited Palestine. We were hugely saddened last week by the passing of our very dear friend and colleague, Hilda Silverman, on Tuesday, May 6th, at 11:30 p.m. at the Mount Auburn Hospital. She died without pain and with dignity in the company of her daughter Jen and her son David. It is impossible merely to mention the numerous issues to which Hilda passionately devoted her adult life, or describe the depth of her commitment and knowledge of each issue. Even if it were possible to describe her numerous accomplishments, it would not do justice to the person she was and the many, many lives she touched in so many ways. Beloved by all who knew her, or who worked with her, or who were inspired by her, Hilda had an infinite capacity for compassion and caring. Hilda lived in the highest tradition of Judaic teaching and taught us all what it really means to be a Jew. This commentator feels privileged to have known Hilda in his life. Let us pause for a minute of silence to honor Hilda's life and wish her well on her journey. This is Sharif Pham for This Week in Palestine.